Bill 5014, the Operations Bill for the Department of Education, and House Bill 5015, which is the Grant and Aid Bill for the Department of Education. Before I open the public hearing, members, we have today and tomorrow morning scheduled in to finish the public hearings on these two bills. If we don't get finished, we'll be having another session that'll start at 1 o'clock on Tuesday here in this room to finish up, because Wednesday morning we are starting on the other funds budgets, and I think that you have all the schedules there. And because we have all the analysts lined up and scheduled in, it would really wreak havoc in LFO to change the schedule at this point. So if you have questions, please make sure they're short questions as we move through this. And with that, I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 5014 and 5015 and call forward Mr. Seward.
You say that as though havoc is a bad thing.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Seward with the Office of Special Education. And if I have comments today, I'll make sure that they're short comments. So before I get started with the rest of the presentation, and I believe we left off on slide 8 of the special education slides, and then we actually covered the information on the next two slides. So I want to go back to slide 8. However, there was a couple of questions about the Townsend Gifted Program. However, I want to first address the question, Madam Chair, that you had about the other funds amounts and the apparent discrepancy between inside budget amounts versus the front page or the second page amount of $12.8 million. What has happened here is that we, as we progressed down the road, we had a $12.8 million figure to work with. We started doing some detailed analysis. The analysis showed up on the next pages, but never got rolled back up to the front page. So it was basically my fault, and I apologize for that. I did give you a page that looks like this, which shows the actual amounts and for which programs the $13.4 million or $13.5 million are spent for. Just as a side, these funds are other funds, but all of these funds are set aside from the state school fund for specific programs. Two of those programs are state-supported programs, long-term treatment and care, as you see there, $11.6 million or $11.7 million, hospital programs at about $1 million, and the out-of-state placement fund, $800,000. Now, all of these programs, the long-term care and the hospital programs for many, many years were funded at this level through the county school fund billing system. So we would bill back to the county school fund, and if there was no funds available, we'd bill to the school district that was the resident district of the child. We'd accrue those dollars to the department and put them in what was known as the county school fund account, and then spend those dollars out as other funds. Last session, legislature passed a policy, adopted a policy that we would not do the county school fund billing any longer. Funds were running out in those county school funds. It was very difficult. It meant a lot of billing, a lot of processing. So we eliminated the county school fund and, in fact, now have a set-aside out of the state school funds for these programs, still considered other funds, and still in an account known as the county school fund billing accounts.
So the source of all these dollars is general funds, then?
General funds from the state school funds, that's right.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like to return then to slide 8. At the bottom, services for students identified as talented and gifted. Up until the current governor's balanced budget, we've had about $200,000 each biennium to operate statewide services for children. We operated that through universities and six universities around the state who had centers for training for school districts within their geographic locations. These funds were reduced during the five special sessions and have been eliminated in the governor's balanced budget. I think, Madam Chair, Representative Smith asked the question about whether all children are talented and gifted. And I believe that that's true. I believe that all children have all kinds of characteristics, strengths, and weaknesses. All children may have some type of learning disability. I have a vision impediment and a hearing impediment. So really the issue is, what is our system the culture that we establish in schools allow and accommodate to for children and can provide services that are appropriate for those children. At some point, the environment no longer provides services within the context of what's available, the curriculum instruction in the regular classrooms. For those kids, we need to provide some additional resources, some additional services, and that's true for students with disabilities, and it's also true for children who have academic talents that exceed what goes on in the regular classroom or is easily accommodated to. Those are generally the children that we serve through the Talented and Gifted program. It sometimes takes rather dramatic changes in their curriculum, takes dramatic changes in the classrooms that they participate in. It takes special accommodations and instruction, and that's what this program purports to do.
Follow-up? Yeah, we had some questions on Friday. We threw a bunch of questions at you at the last minute. Hal? No, I'll save that second. Why are we continuing with the Talented Gifted program when there really is very little funding to do it justice?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think that the legislature and the Department of Education has for a number of years agreed that talented and gifted children have value and worth and provide that we need to provide some accommodations to their needs. There's, I think, a disconnect between what our intention is for these children, what schools should provide for these children, and what we fund through funding mechanisms at the legislative level and at the department level.
How do you identify at the school level talented and gifted children?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, currently we have in rule, State Board of Education rule, some criteria for identifying children. It's a very high-level criteria. It means that, generally speaking, the criteria identifies kids that are very high-performing students academically in the classes.
By taking a test?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, there's actually three components that go into identification system. One is academic achievement tests, cognitive ability tests, and recommendations by teachers, parents, and others. All that data is put together in a file or a case and then evaluated by a team at the schools to determine whether the child meets the criteria and, secondly, whether the child needs special services.
Okay. Now, going back to my original question, once you identify these children and they're put into special services, what are the special services you're giving them?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, it's a difficult question to answer. Schools will develop programs that work in that school or within the district. All districts don't do it the same way. All schools don't do it the same way. But let me just give you a couple of examples. We have some students who are extremely talented in mathematics. Some schools may provide an independent study program for that child in advanced mathematics. Other schools may move the child to an advanced math course within the classes that are available in middle school and high school. Some schools bring the kids together in a particular classroom, maybe a half a dozen to a dozen kids that all have a similar talent and provide direct instruction to those children. So there's a variety of models and alternatives that can be used.
Okay, just one final question. Does No Child Left Behind have a provision for a talented and gifted or something like that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, it does. No Child Left Behind is permissive in the sense that we can use some dollars at the state level to increase training for teachers to do to provide services for talented and gifted children.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to skip a couple slides and go up to slide 12. If the members remember, I started out talking about six different elements or components to the Office of Special Education programs.
Senator Gordley.
Please, if we could go back to slide 9.
Sure.
Because I would like to understand the population of students being served.
Okay.
Are all of these students, the 1,188 students, students who've been identified as having mental health issues? Is that how we are to understand that number?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the 1,188 number represents the number of slots or beds or positions in the programs that we fund under long-term treatment and care programs. we will turn over, the programs will turn over those slots several times during the course of biennium, so that the true number of children that are served are exceed that 1,188 children or slots. All of these kids are placed in day treatment or long-term residential treatment programs by the Department of Human Services through their local mental health agencies, Children's Services Division, et cetera, because of very severe mental health needs. Those slots for residential programs and day treatment programs for mental health services are paid through contract with Department of Human Services. The state's policy has been that as those children are placed in those programs, whether residential or day, that the Department of Education should pay for the educational costs for those children while they're there. The reason being that these kids come from all over the state and they'll wind up in Lake Oswego or Portland or Ontario or wherever these day treatment programs are, LeGrand School District or LeGrand, that they impact that school district and that without outside of the control of the school district. In other words, the school district really can't control the numbers of kids and the severity of the needs, et cetera. So the legislature passed a policy many years ago that we would alleviate that local district from that impact. That's really an impact because of what the state's done. And so we provide the educational services.
How many, Madam Chair, how many of the 53 contractors are mental health providers?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, all of them.
All of them?
Yeah.
Now, given the cutbacks in mental health services at the county level and in every county, are any of these services to children who would need them in jeopardy?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, they are. I believe that the Department of Human Services has a reduced number of slots in the governor's balanced budget. A reduced number of slots below the 1188. We're planning on working with the children, the slots that are left, the children that will be in those slots. We've had a discussion, I think Sue and Linda and I have all had a discussion about what would those reduced numbers of slots do in terms of budgeting, and we can work out the numbers as soon as we know what the number of slots are remaining.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I would like to see that report. I would like to understand what will be the impact given the loss of services for these children who would otherwise need mental health treatment and services in their communities.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would be glad to work on that. I believe, though, that that's a report that would be joint between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education. We can clearly speak to the educational issues for these children. I think that the mental health issues with a reduced number of slots, basically a lack of places to put children who need that level of services, one that we need to discuss with the Department of Human Services.
Yes, and I understand the distinction between who does what. I would just like to know that the two parties are talking and the two parties are in agreement in what the plan will be and understand what the impact will be, and then we all need to understand what that impact will be in loss of services, because that's what we're talking about, a loss of services.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be glad to work on that for you.
Thank you.
A follow-up question to Senator Gordley's, and one of the things that became quite obvious to me as we went through the public testimony that we had was that there is a lot of interface in the special education arena and in the specialty programs, mental health and things like that, between the Department of Human Services and their service provision system and the Department of Ed and the education providing piece of it. And I'm wondering, you're talking about a dialogue agency to agency, but it would seem that an important piece of this would be actually way further down in the delivery system, at the level of the cities or the counties or wherever the services are put together. And I'm wondering how people interface on these issues. What are the forums where the social service people and the education people get together to talk about how to make the best use of these funds?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely correct. I mean, the real forum that needs to occur is really at the county level and or school districts that surround these long-term treatment care programs. It's the school district where it's located. It's the school districts that are sending, that have children sent there by the state. It's the county mental health units that really make decisions about the operation of those programs and how they work for kids. School districts are key being involved in the discussions. As Senator Gordley points out, there's impacts for a reduced number of slots or beds in these programs, a lack of service, a lack of placement option. Local school districts, however, that have these children in their schools, in their classrooms, still have to deal with all of the mental health issues that these kids have and still have to pay, many of them have to pay for the types of services because it's combined under the IEP. So they receive a tremendous impact when there's a failure to have sufficient resources in these long-term care and treatment programs, and also, by the way, in the hospital programs. So there needs to be numbers of people at the table when they talk. Now, let me give you a couple of examples. In Southern Oregon, or in the Medford area, there is a cross-agency team that meets on a regular basis to discuss these very issues with kids and the use of the long-term treatment and care programs to meet mental health needs of kids and to help school districts be able to provide education. We have a number of school districts around the state that are replicating the level of mental health services in long-term treatment care programs because there's not enough slots, there's not enough places to put kids to receive these critical services. So they develop their own programs and either in consultation with a local private mental health service provider or multiple districts or an ESD. So we see different ways that school districts are looking to provide the level of service for the mental health needs as well as the educational needs. One of the reasons that they do that is that very often the mental health services that are provided in the long-term treatment and care program, particularly in residential programs, will turn into an educational service in the IEP of the child with the local school district. And so when there's not available these mental health slots in these programs, school districts still have to provide many of the same services, and at, by the way, at a very high cost. So they're looking at ways of being very efficient and effective in delivering the services that they combine together and attempt to start their own programs.
In each of the counties, we have a commission for children and families, a mm-hmm. forum where all of the providers are supposed to come together, the goal, I think, is to provide as holistic a group of services as possible to the people that need them. What is the Department of Education and the school district's role in the commissions? Is there any statutory language there that that puts an involvement in place?
Madam Chair, I have to plead ignorance about the statutory authority for the Department of Education or school districts and those county programs. I'd have to defer to someone who may have the answer, or I can find it out and bring it to you tomorrow.
If you could, I would be very interested, because it would seem to me that would be a valuable forum mm-hmm. for the discussion to take place. And I'm wondering if there is a mechanism that facilitates that mm-hmm. happening.
Madam Chair, I'd be glad to bring that information back in terms of the statutory authority to get some information about whether those entities at the county level or local level are being used for this discussion. I'd have to do a little bit more research, so I'll be glad to do that.
Madam Chair, follow up, Senator Gordon?
Yes, just one additional question. Do you have information now coming from districts that would tell us how they are planning to deal with the loss of services?
Madam Chair, Representative or Senator Gordley, not in any formal sense. What I get is I talk to local special ed directors and hear that they're worried about the loss of these slots in the long-term treatment care programs. Many of them are already starting to think about how they can join up this consortium to figure out a way to provide those services. We do have a small pilot project with several districts to start developing local planning groups across mental health organizations as well as educational organizations to start looking at ways of providing services for these children. This is the first time, I think, that I can't remember a time when we had a substantial reduction in the number of slots available in long-term treatment care programs. So we're breaking some new ground here, and I think school districts are thinking seriously about it. I talked to them individually, as special ed directors. I know that if and when this does happen, that we'll have to figure out a way to cost-efficient way deliver the same services other ways.
Thank you.
Senator Messley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you clarify for me, I'm a little confused on the number of slots we have had in the past, capacity, what we have now, and what the total number of students served is?
Madam Chair, Senator Messerly, the 1188, in the best of my memory, is the highest number of slots we've had available for a while. I'd have to check the numbers over the last several biennium, but I believe that that's the case. These slots do turn over on a fairly regular basis, and to get an actual count of numbers of children actually served, I'd have to do some research and bring that number back to you.
So I think in terms of aligning our budgets here, we need to put some energy into talking with the human services folks and find out where this is actually going to end up being. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members, what I think is real important to remember is that the needs of these children don't disappear. They still need mental health services. They still need educational services. Many of these children are children with disabilities and under the requirements of the special education law, federal law, so they will receive the services, and many of the services. So we're either going to pay for it through long-term treatment and care programs, which I believe provide a substantially higher quality service in many cases. We're going to pay for it through the school districts and through federal funds and general funds through state school funds. But the children's needs need to be provided for. We can't just assume that they're not going to have to need these services.
Let me clarify then. I have an example in my district, a facility that received mental health dollars through the DARTS program, mm-hmm. and they are no longer getting those funds, and so the facility is going to lose all of the DARTS slots that they have, except for the ones that are Medicaid eligible. Mm-hmm. So what I hear you say, and please correct me if I'm not getting this correctly, that the students that are not eligible for the human services reimbursement piece, are you saying that they will be entirely picked up by the Department of Education piece?
Madam Chair, the DARTS programs are a component of the programs that we're talking about here, the long-term treatment and care programs. DARTS are one of the components. The children will not, in your particular case, there's a reduction in the numbers of slots maybe completely in that particular program. Those children will remain or go back to their local school districts. In some cases, depending on the child's IEP, some of those services may be provided through the education program. Not in all cases, however. Not all services will be paid for by the school districts that have those children. So there'll be a reduction in the level of services for the children, no doubt. Some will remain, some will not be addressed in the school.
But then am I correct in assuming that for the Department of Education, the number of students served won't decline? It would just be that the services that they'll be getting will be less. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, this program provides educational services to children who are enrolled or placed in either a day or a residential treatment program.
Okay.
Only for those children. So if there's a reduction, say, of 188 slots out of this 1188, we'll have 1,000 slots left. We'll pay for the education of the children in the 1,000 slots. School districts, for the 188 children, the return to their school districts, it'll be a school district planning effort to provide for the educational services as well as some of the mental health services that would be eligible under special education law. So the dollars don't follow the kids. They remain focused on the children who are in the day and residential treatment programs.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gore.
There's still a fuzzy piece here, and it's the assumption that there will be mental health services still existing in local communities, when in fact the capacity is being diminished with budget cuts.
Madam Chair, hold on.
To say that these children are still going to be served in their local school districts, I'm questioning that, because how will they be served? What capacity will we be relying on if, in fact, we are removing the capacity?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I spoke earlier about some of these children being covered under federal law for children with disabilities. Under that federal law, some level of health, mental health services may be provided as required in the IEP of the child. Now, only about a little over 60% of the children, however, that are in these programs, in the mental health contract programs, are not children with disabilities, are not identified as children with disabilities, are not covered under the same federal law, and may not receive any services when they return to their local school district. So it isn't sort of the carte blanche. If you're not here, you go there and you get the same level of services. That doesn't occur. Even with children with disabilities, some what we might call mental health services are not within the purview of the school district. In other words, school districts are not required to provide some services to children under the federal law. Those services will not be provided to those children. But some may. For instance, psychological counseling would be provided by school districts, but some types of social service would not be provided by the school districts for these children. So it really will depend on where the child returns, what kind of program the child returns to, whether they're eligible under special education or not, and then what are the services the school districts have. But clearly, they will not have the same level of services as the long-term treatment care programs have.
I'd like to spend some time with you outside of the hearing, better understanding where we're headed. Mm-hmm. Again, my concern is the loss of capacity and the possible loss of services to a whole host of children who need that treatment, need that intervention.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be glad to do that. You and I share the same concern. I do believe there's many children in those lost slots that won't receive the services they need.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, just to look down that same list on slide 9, I just want to make another comment about children in hospital programs. These programs are very similar in nature to the long-term treatment care, but these are kids who are extremely at risk, health risks, and are in long-term placements in hospitals and need the very similar level of service to the children in long-term treatment care. And this is another area I think we have concerns about. The number of slots are not controlled. In other words, the children who need to be in those hospital programs are in those hospital programs. And so it's a variable amount of children on a daily basis almost, and the Department of Education struggles to keep up with the cost of the education for those children as they enter and leave these hospital programs. It's a budgetary issue. It's one that we manage our way through, but I just want to let you know that these are very needy kids, and I believe as a manager that we need to provide the best kind of services that's available for kids who are critical. I mean, absolutely critical. Okay. Now we're going to skip forward to page 12, I believe. And I'll go through the next set of slides rather rapidly and answer any questions you may have. One of the functions of the Office of Special Education is to manage grants, we have several staff and a rather extensive computer system that does just that. It manages data, it makes federal reports, it applies for federal grants, and then we distribute those dollars to local school districts and other agencies. It includes about 13 federal grant reports annually to the federal government, extensive reports based on 72,000 children across the state. It's a massive job to get all that data in, crunch it down in the way that the federal government requires us to do. And this data, by the way, to collect the data and report it to the federal government makes us eligible for federal grants on an annual basis. So it's real critical to our agency and to school districts and to other agencies out there. By the way, long-term treatment care and hospital programs also receive benefit from these federal funds. So our whole system of serving kids is dependent on our ability to, on a very timely basis, collect and report this data to the federal government and to you so that you can have the most accurate and up-to-date data as possible. It includes, as you see on slide 13, a number of federal grant programs that we operate out of the Office of Special Education. In total, something in the neighborhood of $157 million on an annual basis. So it's a critical piece of work that delivers dollars to school districts so they can continue to provide services for students with disabilities. Slide 14, you will see the basic costs of the grants management system and the delivery. I misquoted it. I said that it was earlier 157. We're projecting $168 million for the next biennium. To derive those dollars, we spend about $1.5 million, or about $750,000 a year, to get the data, report the data, make the applications, deliver the dollars to the school district. So it's a fairly cost-efficient operation. It's heavily technology-dependent. It's web actuated, so we can get applications to school districts on the web. We get data through the web to make these reports and report the data to the federal government on the web. So we've worked very hard to keep current with what the technology is capable of so that we can make the best use of the dollars possible. The next slide, 15, is a series of activities that the Office of Special Education carries out that is accountability for both the state agency and accountability for local school districts. Part of that is collecting and reporting base data on children and on services, but it also includes making sure that programs and school districts are run according to the basic requirements of the federal law under IDEA. We have teams of individuals that go from the office that go to school districts to work with them to ensure compliance with all the federal requirements, and there are a number of them. And to ensure that where there might be problems, we identify those and assist the school districts to correct the problems. Slide 17 points out that about $1.3 million is spent on a biennial basis to operate that accountability system with school districts and other agencies to generate reports to assist the school districts to correct any problems they may have. I want to just brag for a minute about our accountability system, what we used to call monitoring. We've moved away from sort of the COP role with our hats. And have gone to a continuous improvement model, which collects data, helps school districts evaluate themselves, identify any compliance issues, and then work with them to improve so that they have no compliance problems and, in fact, implement better practices for children. It's a much better model. It's one that school districts enjoy and appreciate as compared to when I was doing monitoring 20 years ago. There wasn't such a joy when we saw us coming. These days, I think that school districts really believe we're there to not only point out where the issues are, but to help them fix those issues.
One of the things that I hear a lot from the special ed teachers are that the paperwork's a killer. Is that getting better for them? I mean, does your data collection system assist with that?
Madam Chair, it does in some cases, although the data collection system also creates work. So that's part of what you hear teachers and administrators talk about, the paperwork for reporting children annually in a very, very detailed way, by the way. I think we're at close to 120 elements in our student reporting form. So one of the paper chases that we do is around student reporting, student data. Another is IEP preparation and the time that it takes to prepare IEPs, and then to collect data to report on how well a child's doing. All of those are required under federal law, so the ability of the state to impact that is fairly small. We have a very small window of being able to impact. What we have done, what the legislature encouraged us session before last, actually, was to ask the Department of Education where we're meeting the very basic minimum requirements for paperwork. In other words, don't exceed that the basic requirements of the federal law. Don't incur additional paperwork on our own, which we've done. One of the things we did, at the legislature's behest, was to have a statewide standard IEP that meets the basic requirements. Part of the paperwork chase is that school districts will, for good reason or for what they think is the right reasons, include additional reporting information or different components to the IEP or more information discussed in the IEP, so you get kind of a variation across districts. The legislature's policy was let's have a statewide standard IEP that everybody uses so we know that we're right at the minimum requirements but not above those. We've done that. We've gone through three cycles of improving those IEPs so that they are standard and basic, and I think we have reduced the paperwork. But at some point we hit the bottom, where the federal law says you have to do these things, and those are the things that we have to do.
Thank you.
The next slide, slide 18, speaks to issues around legal services. The Department of Education has a rather extensive legal service unit, about 3.5 FTE, in fact, out of the Office of Special Education. There are a number of legal requirements under IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, that requires to conduct certain legal activities. One of those is to operate a due process hearings system, which we do under contract. We have hearings officers where parents can file for a due process hearing concerning some behavior of the school district that they believe is inappropriate or illegal, and the hearings officer will hear the case and issue a finding and an order. We also have a complaints process operated out of the Office of Special Education. School parents may file complaints to the department for suspected violations of federal law by the district or failure to meet the child's needs by the school district. We have six complaint investigators that we hire on a continuous basis that provide the complaints investigations and assist the department of issuing orders where an order is necessary. So we have two fairly weighty or major legal processes that we operate and are required by federal law to operate. What we have done over the last several years is to figure out ways that we can solve problems before they get to that sort of formal legalistic system. We've done that through mediation. We offer a very extensive mediation service to school districts and parents so that if both agree that they can enter into mediations. We find that system is very effective. Most complaints that enter into mediation are resolved before they go to the formal investigation process. We've also have been able to forestall formal due process hearings through mediation. We're always looking for different ways to help resolve problems. We have, for instance, a series of about 10 or 12 grants to school districts to come up with alternative dispute resolution processes other than mediation. What are some other ways that schools can resolve conflicts with parents? Those have been very successful. Districts have been very creative in figuring out ways to communicate better and to resolve problems. And by the way, the basic issues in many of these cases, I'd say in the majority of them, is really a communications issue. At some point, the parents in the school district no longer communicate effectively with one another. So it turns into a conflict rather than an ability to resolve a problem. What we're trying to do is figure out ways to resolve problems. And how do we get that done? We get people talking to each other and communicating with each other. This is a fairly expensive system, but required by law.
Do you maintain a log of complaints by district?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, yes, we do.
Can you make that available to the committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, we certainly could.
All right. Would the log give us, what I'm looking for is a sense of what kind of complaints are out there and how they're being resolved and within what time frame?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley, we can provide you with a log. It depends on how many years you want to go back. We have a log that goes back 20-odd years, so we can give you maybe the last couple of years. Let you. And they really represent what's going on right now rather than what went on 10 years ago.
The last two biennia would be...
4 years?
Yes. And then also, what current legal challenges are facing districts as well as the department?
Madam Chair, Senator Gourley would be glad to bring that back.
Thank you.
Representative Martin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As just kind of follow-up to that, I realize we're spending, almost $1.7 million on this. How much are the local districts spending on this as well? Like you say, it's a communication problem, but it gets into an adversarial position, and I think we're probably spending more money on lawyers than if we actually spend it on, teacher's aides or something to cover the IEP problem.
Madam Chair, Representative March, the department's never collected that data from the local school district. What's the cost of local districts? And then compile that into some overall cost to the state for these legal processes. All of us at the Department of Education and the Office of Special Ed have the N of one information. We know that Portland Public Schools or Salem Kaiser or Eugene has spent X number of dollars on attorneys and processes and time from teachers, et cetera. So the answer is a sort of an informal yes. In fact, there's many more dollars being spent in this than the money you see here by local agencies around complaints and due process hearings. What our attempt is always is to figure out some way that we can insert some resolution early on in the process so that the least amount of dollars are spent over these challenges by whoever brings the complaint or the request for due process hearing. Some of them, however, are reasonable complaints and reasonable due process hearings requests, and we need to go through the process to resolve some fairly knotty legal issues and service issues. So you'll never be able to eliminate the process completely.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Given those comments, it would be helpful if you provided, along with the what I'm calling a log, some analysis of what are the trends, what are the challenges within what you're seeing out there in the way of complaints.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we actually do that very thing on an annual basis and provide that information to school districts so that they can see what are the issues, what are the challenges. We'd be glad to bring you back 4 years' worth of that information.
That would be excellent. Thank you.
Madam Chair, let me continue. We have been running to about 70 to 80 complaints annually and approximately 30 to 40 due process hearings annually. So you can see, you know, the level of work that we do to do both those due process hearings and complaints. And we, and again, through mediation and other services, trying to get ahead of the problem early on and improve communications and try to resolve complaints.
And would these be issues that were unable to be resolved at the district level that bubbled up to the department, or are they issues that are just germane to a policy level in the department?
Madam Chair, let me, when I was working as a director in the Office of Special Education, let me kind of just give you sort of the typical day. I would get 2, 3, 4 calls a day from parents who are upset with school districts. They believe the district wasn't following the law appropriately, wasn't providing the needs for the services for the children, or in some other way, in their minds, violated their rights as parents of children with disabilities. In all cases, we would talk to that parent, try to get the kernel information from them, and then ask them to call the school district, because many times they hadn't called the school district. They'd call us directly. So we provide them an opportunity to go back to the school district and lodge that same information, provide that same information. At the same time, I'd pick up the phone after the call and call the special ed director at that school district and say, I just got this call from this parent. Here are the issues that the parent's bringing up. Can you get a hold of this parent and have a discussion, try to resolve the problem? Many, many, many complaints or concerns that parents have get resolved right then, that you just start the communication process. After that point, if there still seems to be some kind of confrontation between the parent and the school district, then generally they'll get to a complaint or may get to a complaint that we'll have to deal with in a more formal system. Many times, however, just being able to talk to the parent and say, you know, you may believe that's true, but this is really what the law says. Here's what the law requires, and the school district seems to be doing that. You maybe had a misconception about what the law requires. Many, many parents would be okay with that, and they'd say, oh, I understand now, or I can talk to the district more in a more informed way. But many times they will come through as a complaint or due process hearing. Does that help? Yeah. Okay. Any other questions about the legal systems? It's a very complicated, complex process that we have. And it's by the way, IDEA is, I know somebody brought in here a stack of paper that was this thick on No Child Left Behind. Well, I'll challenge them page to page. IDEA is a very complex, very difficult law to understand. It has many, many requirements. Our office really is sort of the first ability to respond to that law, inform school districts of the requirements, help parents understand what the law requires in terms of meeting the needs of their children. I'm going to skip now to page 20. Statewide capacity. This is the last in the series, but certainly not the least. And it's the ones, these are the things that probably my staff in the Office of Special Education are most proud of. These are activities that school districts have requested from us in terms of services to them, helping them increase their capacity, provide better services to children, use best practices to just overall expand the quality of services for children statewide that have disabilities. It includes reading improvement instruction. We have a project, and I'm not going to cover all of these, but just to point out a couple. We have a major reading improvement effort that's a grades 4 through 12 effort, trying to implement best practices in reading with school districts to improve reading of with children with disabilities. I must say, however, that, by the way, that this has other impacts and effects. In other words, other children who may not be in special education will have their reading instruction improved because we have a program in that particular school or that particular district that demonstrates good practices in reading instruction for 4 through 12. Major issue in special education, as you well know, is recruiting and maintaining teachers in the special educational ranks. We knew that this is the case. It's a national trend. It's one that all of us in special education and policymakers have known for a long time. We've initiated a recruitment and retention project in partnership with Western Oregon University Teaching Research. We have a website available. We meet with school districts. We provide some assistance in their recruitments. We assist them in quality professional developments so that teachers can be retained and maintained in the classrooms with children with disabilities. We hear from teachers that the paperwork is a difficult thing to deal with. That's one of the things that drives teachers out of the ranks in special education, quite honestly. How do we deal with that? How do we train them? How do we provide them the resources and assistance to stay there and do the best job possible with the children? Skipping to the bottom, a traumatic brain injury project. We've received funds from the federal government to assist both schools and adult systems so that individuals with traumatic brain injury have resources available that can do the best they can in school and transition into adult life with support systems that will help them through the rest of their lives. We're pretty proud of this project. It's one that traumatic brain injury is a fairly recent definition under federal law. It's also people with traumatic brain injuries have a lot of hidden disabilities that we need to attend to and make resources available to. With that, and without going through the whole list, what I want to say kind of at the end is that we work with almost every public agency in the state that touches children. We provide services. We have discussions. We encourage them to use best practices. We encourage them to meet the needs of children with disabilities. It's a very large job, and we do it many times with very little dollars, but we're still very successful with these programs.
There are, just as there are in human service areas, with the federal funds that come through maintenance of effort issues in special education, can you talk to the committee about what's going on in that venue?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we recently had a complaint filed against Portland Public Schools and the Oregon Department of Education, the state of Oregon, that we have failed to maintain fiscal effort with four programs for birth to five children. We are charged with investigating the complaint, the Department of Education is. So we've initiated that investigation. We're going to actually work with another agency to get a third-party independent investigator to work with the department to determine what our vulnerabilities are. It's certainly a concern to us. My guess is it would be a concern to you that we have maintained effort. There are penalties if we haven't, but at this point it's very, very early in the process. I can't estimate what the vulnerabilities are at this point, except that there may be. We were just recently told by the U.S. Office of Education, Office of Special Education Programs, that we needed to continue with the Department of Education needed to continue investigating itself in the state of Oregon for maintenance of efforts. So we're now at the very start of working on how to get that investigation done. I have personally been in touch with seven or eight other states that are high on the list for having deficits going into the 03-05 period. All of them have some similar concerns about their maintenance of effort. They operate differently. They work their budgets differently. So we plan to come together in Washington, D.C. the week of May 25th to talk over our similar concerns, identify how we have similar processes in budgeting and expenditures to determine where we all are with this. This is a national problem. Clearly, 50 states have downturns in their revenues. That equates to downturns in funding available for special education. To what extent we have a maintenance of effort problem really depends on two things. One is to what extent we're alike as states and what other states are doing about maintenance of effort so I can learn some things from them. Secondly, that needs to be several states that go to talk to the federal government, not just one. I'd prefer that we were joined in arms and that we know what our issues are and can have that discussion. I've had one phone call conversation with Office of Special Education Programs about this very issue. All I can say is that we have no guidelines on how they define maintenance of effort in any detail. When asked, they aren't ready and prepared to answer our questions. So I believe we're at the very beginning of this process, and to really know where we are financially in the state will take several months.
Thank you. Does that complete your presentation?
Madam Chair, I think I am completed my presentation. That's right.
Are there any questions or comments? Senator Gorder.
Yes, I do have a question, and appreciating very much all that you have been presenting to us. And my question goes to you, but also to our operations deputy. How many employees are there in the Office of Special Education?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, I have 31.5 FTE.
How many are minority or people of color?
Madam Chair, Senator Gorley, I have no employees who are people of color. I have several individuals who have disabilities and might represent other protected classes, but at this point, no employees of color.
I think that in this department, as well as throughout the Department of Education, and I'm not just directing this to you, I'm really directing it to the department and all of its leadership, we have some real challenges and huge opportunities to diversify the workforce. Our student population, through changing demographics, really dramatic changes in demographics, brings with it some huge multicultural challenges, and I'm not yet getting an understanding that the department itself is able to reflect back to our communities around the state that it's up to that challenge. And so I'm going to need to hear more from you and Mr. Greenfield and others, and this is a conversation that goes to our superintendent as well, about how we're going to get to a more diverse workforce within the Department of Education, and particularly in this department, the Office of Special Ed, given the population you're serving out there around the state. And how are we going to get to those staff development opportunities and recruitment and retention activities that will lead us to a more diverse organization than the one that we know today?
Mr. Greenfield.
Madam Chair, for the record, Mike Greenfield, Deputy Superintendent. Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, we have two challenges. The first one, Superintendent Castillo has spoken to during the first 100 days, and that is that, to reflect the problem with not being reflective of the community and needing to build a capacity to offer that variety of responses through hiring and retention practices. And that's a high priority for Superintendent Castillo. The other problem, of course, is we're in a shrinking budget era, and we want to be careful as we downsize that we don't lose ground in this area. And Superintendent Castillo recognizes that, has made that point repeatedly in staff meetings with upper management, and as we proceed, and when we do have the opportunities to recruit hire, when we think about retention and when we think about development opportunities, she's made it clear that this is a major facet of her agenda as Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Madam Chair, I would just I appreciate the word, and we will be looking for some different actions. I note that in the Office of Superintendent, there are no minority employees. In the Office of Deputy Superintendent, there are no minority employees. And you correct me if there's been anything new, correct me as I go through this. In the Office of Assessment and Evaluation, one minority employee. In the Office of Curriculum, Instruction, and Field Services, two. In the Office of Professional Technical Education, none. In the Office of Special Education, as we just heard, none. In the Office of Student Services, there may be four. And again, this is our State Department of Education needing to do a lot of work, and with all of our help, to become a much more diverse and leading organization.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, Superintendent Castillo has made this point as vigorously as you have, and intends that we improve. Again, we're in a era where we're not going to do a lot of hiring, but we need to be sure that we pay attention to the retention issues as we shrink in force, and when we do hire, she's made it clear that this is a priority, and we'll keep the committee informed as we make progress.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
I would just like to echo Senator Gordley's concerns with this area, because I do think we'd be enriched with the hiring practice of more minorities. It's definitely reflective of our culture and what's happening out there in our school systems, and I do think it's very important. And I've talked to Superintendent Castillo about this very issue in regards to licensing of teachers, because I feel the master's degree is a barrier for diversity, not only because it's extremely expensive, hard to come by, extreme amount of time, and I think maybe we can do a better job at the baccalaureate level in teaching teachers how to teach than what the current curriculum is on that. That's just my two cents.
Appreciate the committee's support of that, the direction that Superintendent Castillo wants to take the agency.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation on special ed. And I will call Ms. Mulholland and Mr. Wee May from the School for the Deaf and the School for the Blind. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Morgan and members of the subcommittee. My name is Jane Mulholland. I'm the Director of Special Schools, which includes the Oregon School for the Blind, excuse me, and the Oregon School for the Deaf. And I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you this morning. The information that you'll see on the second slide will give you an overview of the special schools budget. Our other funds are made up of three primary sources: receipts revenue, reimbursed expenditures, and state school fund, and as Mr. Seward said, which was formerly county school fund. Our ongoing federal funds are primarily from the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. We do on occasion have some small federal grants that are targeted for school improvement, and I'll speak about two of those just a little bit later. The special schools budget has two major categories. Approximately 85% of our budget is in personal services, and like most school districts, the majority of our resources does go to staffing. The second category is a combination of services and supplies, capital outlay, and special payments, and that comprises approximately 15% of the budget. The resources are divided between the two schools, approximately one-third for the School for the Blind and two-thirds for the School for the Deaf, and this is based on enrollment, staffing, and the size of the facilities. And
What's the other funds component? Where does that money come from?
Madam Chair, there are three sources primarily: receipts, revenue, and these would be some rentals of the facilities that we have on the campuses and facilities usage. Those are the primary sources. Reimbursed expenditures, those would be things such as the school nutrition lunch program, Medicaid areas such as that, student transportation, and then state school fund.
Is the transportation reimbursement then general fund is where it originates?
Madam Chair, we use money in our general services and supplies to provide transportation on the behalf of some school districts up and down the I-5 corridor primarily. We in turn bill the school districts for that service and they reimburse us.
Thank you.
And as you can see, between the two schools, we have 162.5 FTE, and I could let you know that approximately 30%, just a little over 30% of that FTE, is individuals of color or disabilities at the two schools. The mission of the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf has two primary components. And before I talk about that, I'd like to alert you to the fact that you do have copies of the biennial reports of both schools in your notebooks, as well as some additional documents that will give you information on our student results, our program areas, and our future directions. And in the time I have with you this morning, I'd like to highlight some of the areas. And as I talk about the two schools, I'd like you to think about our schools and what I say in the context of the four priorities that Superintendent Castillo set out for you when she was before you on April 23rd. The Oregon School for the Blind and the Oregon School for the Deaf are concrete examples of schools and programs that are built around achieving the superintendent's priorities, and those were to close the achievement gap and accelerate learning, being able to focus instruction so that all students become good readers, additional emphasis on developing strong middle schools and high schools, and finally that the two schools as part of the Department of Education would be run in an efficient and accountable manner. The mission of the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf has two primary components. The first is to provide a comprehensive educational set of services to children who are visually impaired, blind, deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind. And these children are placed at one of the two schools because their needs can best be met in this type of environment. And I'd like to describe that environment for you. At the School for the Blind, everything from the orientation of sidewalks, the design of buildings, the way classroom instruction is delivered, bulletin boards, the way food is prepared and served, playgrounds, everything is designed to take into account the learning needs of blind children. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, everything in that environment and all the learning is designed to allow children to have access to that environment, children who cannot hear. And so to that end, all of the staff, whether they are nurses, secretaries, groundskeepers, custodians, teachers, dormitory counselors, all of the staff are required and expected to learn some level of sign language. And when a child can go up to literally any staff person on campus and get help, that creates a safe environment and a rich learning environment. In addition to that, the classes are in both schools are small size so that the children's individual needs can be met. And especially important, I'd like to point out, at the School for the Deaf is that all of the instruction is designed so that children can progress at the same level as their hearing peers, with the curriculum being the materials being modified so that it accommodates the children's language needs. A child who's in fifth grade needs to get fifth grade content, even though their reading level at that time, because this is a developing issue for deaf children, may be at second or third grade level, but they need that fifth grade content. And so all of the instruction is designed to allow continuous progress in the academic areas. In addition to the classroom instruction, there is a set of educational, what we call related services, offered at both schools, and this includes things such as audiology, orientation and mobility, counseling, occupation or physical therapy, to name some of them. And these services are determined for each child by their individual education program team. And for those children who live too far from Salem to attend the school on a daily basis, residential services are provided. The second component to our mission is to provide outreach services to the state. And these would be could be for children who do not attend the two schools but who are visually impaired or hearing impaired, and their families, to school districts, and to the public in general. And to that end, during the 2001-2002 school year, the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf provided over 4,500 outreach services to individuals in the state. And another part of our outreach, we believe that it's important for us to be the best stewards we can of our facilities. And to that end, during the previous school year, we had over 1,600 individuals or organizations use our facilities. Of those, 145 of them were state agencies. And so we think it's important that we allow others to benefit from the facilities we have. It's important to understand the role that these two schools have in the education of Oregon. And, of course, we know that it's the responsibility of the state to provide educational opportunities for all of our students, and that no one setting can meet the needs of every child. And consequently, what we have is a complex system that does involve a variety of options. And in 1870 and 1873, the Oregon legislature established the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind, respectively, to provide children who were blind and deaf with such an avenue for receiving their public education. And while, of course, things have changed since the 1870s, and it's no longer an expectation that all children who are deaf or blind would be educated at one of the special schools, one of the things that hasn't changed is the need for a center-based, comprehensive program where all of the staff are fully trained and truly understand the unique educational needs of this population of students. And to this end, OSD, which is currently in its 133rd year of operation, and OSB, which just celebrated its 130th anniversary, are proud to be part of Oregon's system of public education. The statutory authority for the two schools is found in ORS 346, and the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Education Act also provides that states have a continuum of placement options, again, because no one setting is going to be appropriate for all children. Almost every state has a special school or special schools as we do. In fact, several states have more than one such school. And for those states that do not have a special school, they are required to pay out-of-state tuition and transportation costs for those students for whom this placement would be appropriate.
Question. Do we have out-of-state students in our deaf and blind schools?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, no, we do not. We do have the ability to accept out-of-state tuition. The legislature gave us that authority a couple of bienniums ago, but we have not actually had, we've had inquiries, but no actual students placed with us.
Just a quick little question, just on history.
Mm-hmm.
Other states, did they establish their schools as early as we did, do you know?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I don't know the different histories, but deaf education was one of the earliest areas of specialty education, if you will, that developed in the United States. The history of deaf education is very, very strong and early in the United States. So I know back east, you will probably find many schools that are actually older than ours.
Right. Thank you.
I'd like to give you an understanding of how the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf fit into the placement options that are available for these students in Oregon. There are approximately 700 students, kindergarten through 12th grade, who are visually impaired. And OSB, the School for the Blind, serves students from three primary categories. The first would be children who are first grade through eighth grade, roughly, who come from rural areas, who have significant needs because of their visual impairments, and they need services at a frequency or an intensity that may not be available to them because of the rural nature of their area. And these services would include braille development, orientation and mobility, as well as, of course, developing the regular academic skills. The second category of students at the School for the Blind would be students, this could be all ages, kindergarten through 12th grade, but these are students that have are visually impaired but have significant multiple disabilities, and the collection of services and the intensity of services they need would not be available to them locally, and they would come to the School for the Blind. The third category of students is a group who would have graduated from a program in their local area with a modified diploma and would still have needs in the area of independent living, transition. They need to come and receive the skills and the training so that they can then take a step and become independent adults in the future, learn how to be able to live in an apartment, manage all the various activities that go along with that, perhaps have support in work experiences and even to post-secondary programs.
How many students are enrolled in the School for the Blind?
Right? Madam Chair, currently we have about 50 students at the School for the Blind.
And what about the School for the Deaf?
Madam Chair, at the School for the Deaf we have 130 students. And moving into that area, there are approximately 1,000 students in the state of Oregon who are identified as deaf or hard of hearing. But of those 1,000 students, just over 350 of those students are children who rely on sign language as a primary mode of instruction and communication. And then OSD serves approximately 36%, or just over a third of those students who rely on sign language for their instruction and communication. And in addition, students that come to the School for the Deaf also have a characteristic, which is that they have a need to be able to communicate directly with their teachers and with their peers. And there is a difference between being able to use an interpreter and communicate directly with someone in sign language. When you're using an interpreter, you have no control over the language level or the vocabulary content of the speaker. And so this is another aspect of students that come to the School for the Deaf. Partnering.
I just thought I'd interrupt here, and if anybody would like to come to Senator Gordley in our town hall on Saturday, we will have a interpreter there for the public and for my intern who will be speaking.
Okay. Partnering with local school districts and regional programs is an important part of the structure that we have in place. And there is a placement process which involves the local school district, the regional program, and staff from the School for the Blind or School for the Deaf. But once a child is placed in either of the schools, the school district always retains ownership or responsibility for the students. They continue to participate at least annually or however often, which can sometimes be more frequently than once a year, in the child's individual education program meeting and in other significant activities or decisions that occur for the child while they are at the special school. Slide 5 talks about performance, and the message that I like to give you and give others as I have the opportunity to talk about this is that we are schools. Though we are within the Department of Education, we are schools, and as such, it's important for us to be measured against similar standards to other schools and other students. And the first area that I'd like to talk about is academic success. Our students participate in statewide assessments along with all other students in Oregon. And although our numbers are small and it's difficult to aggregate the results, we can look at individual results. And recently at the School for the Deaf, we had 7 students who took the math and problem-solving benchmark test at the 4th benchmark, which, as you know, is the 10th grade level. And 5 of those 7 students met the benchmark. Another way that we can look at success is by looking at our seniors or our graduates. And I'd like to tell you about one of our young men. His name is Aaron Yankus. Aaron has had his entire educational experience at the Oregon School for the Deaf. He started with us as a kindergarten student and is now a senior. And you may have seen him recently. He was named Statesman Journal Scholastic All-Star, so his picture and some information was in the paper. He scored 1,120 on his SAT scores in preparation for college. He has been a 3-time winner of the Oregon Association of the Deaf Reading Award, and he just recently, a couple of weeks ago, received his letter indicating that he's been accepted as a freshman at the Rochester Institute of Technology in New York and will be going there in the fall. When we look at success for students who are visually impaired, and in particular students at the Oregon School for the Blind, it's one of the critical measures is to be able to see how well students can take the information that they learn in the classroom and then apply it in the community. It's one thing to learn something in isolation, but especially when you're visually impaired, you need to be able to use that in the community to have it be worthwhile. And this includes not just the academic information, but the ability to travel on a bus, the ability to make purchases, the ability to communicate with the public. And the way students are able to be successful in these areas is by having staff go out with them into community integration activities and actually work on those skills in natural settings. And during the previous year, 94% of the students at the School for the Blind had monthly community integration activities as part of their regular program. So we think this is a really critical area to look at. Another measure that's important, and the Oregon Shines program told us this was important for all students, was the amount of structured work experience that students would have during high school. And the benchmark that was set for the state was that by the year 2005, 25% of high school students would have had a structured work experience during their 4 years in high school. At the Oregon School for the Blind, 98% of the students who are 14 to 21 have not one during their high school years, but one at least a structured work experience every year annually. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, 100% of the students who are in the vocational diploma program, again, have an annual structured work experience, and 80% of the students overall have at least one structured work experience during their high school. And why do we think this is so important in order to put so much emphasis on that at our two schools? It's because our students, perhaps more than their sighted and hearing peers, have to be able to demonstrate above and beyond question that deaf and blind individuals can make good employees. And we know that the more experiences that we can give them to develop their work skills and especially to develop their work behaviors are very often what make or break someone's ability to retain a job. And so the more experiences that we can give them, the better opportunities they're going to have to be successful in the future. Parents are another good source of measuring success and performance, and you had the opportunity to meet some of our parents Thursday, and I thank you for the opportunity to let everybody testify who was here. It was a remarkable thing to see the hearing go so long, and we appreciate that. We recently asked our parents to tell us how they felt that we were doing, and a complete list of the results of our parent surveys are in your notebooks. But parents overwhelmingly indicated to us that they felt their children had improved in the areas of math, reading, and writing since attending the two schools. And 100% of the parents responding indicated that their children had improved in the areas of independent living. And one of the statistics that I think is particularly important is that 90 to 100% of our parents said that their children's personal pride and self-esteem has improved since attending the two schools. And back on April 23rd, when we opened these hearings, Deputy Superintendent Burke told us that there was research that indicated that students do better when they're known and respected and valued. And I think the results that we see in this area of personal pride and self-esteem really validate the fact that these schools are environments where students thrive. As we look to the future, well, we know that as we look to the future, one of the important things for us to do is to look to the past, and for us, that would be our graduates. You also had the opportunity to meet a couple of our young men who graduated from the School for the Deaf on Thursday and who are now going on to become teachers themselves. And we have highlighted in our biennial reports various alumni from the schools and welcome you to look through that. But what it shows us is that our graduates and individuals with disabilities have the ability to go on and become virtually anything they want. They could become ministers, counselors, teachers, doctors. In fact, we have a former student right now who's in a pre-med program, having graduated from Oregon State. And so the door is really wide open to children that graduate. as we, our goal for the future is just to continue making our program stronger so that our students will be better and better able to take that next step to work or to post-secondary programs. And there are a number of focus areas that we have. At the Oregon School for the Blind, there is a particular segment of the population there where communication skills is just critical. And these are children who currently would be considered to be nonverbal. But the one of the focuses of the School for the Blind for the future is really helping each of these students develop a viable communication system, which will then open the doors for them to supported work experiences and community opportunities in the future. Another goal at the Oregon School for the Blind is to develop a mentorship program. They're working in collaboration with the Oregon Commission of the Blind to develop a mentorship program that would pair visually impaired adults with students to help them, again, gain a greater understanding of what the possibilities are for them for the future. At the Oregon School for the Deaf, one of the goals is to continue developing a small-sized mentoring program, which was started about 2 years ago. This teams a teacher with a small group of students, and that group continues throughout the duration of the child's high school career. And part of the focus is that each of the children or students will develop a specific education plan that takes him or her through high school and then provides better preparation for their next steps. And then another area that is a very significant focus for us is continuing focus on literacy. And I'm very proud to tell you that the Oregon School for the Deaf is one of a handful of high schools in Oregon that requires a ninth grade reading level as part of our standard diploma. Most of the high schools require credits, which of course we do as well, but do not have a competency requirement in order to achieve a diploma. In fact, as a bit of a side note, we had a student this year who was not going to meet that ninth grade. This is actually the first year that students will be graduating under that that requirement. And we had a student who did not know if she was going to meet that requirement, and so at the last minute wanted to transfer back to her local high school for that purpose. And while there may be some challenges that we have to deal with, we're very clear that literacy is just critical for students who are deaf, and that this is an emphasis area that we need to really continue to focus on. As we look to programs for the future, I had mentioned that the Oregon School for the Deaf has two federal grants that I would just like to highlight briefly. One, we are in the third year of a service learning grant. When Salam Noor was here from the Office of Professional Technical Education, he talked about service learning, which of course is a strategy that allows students to learn while serving others. And OSD students provided over 1,000 hours of service to the community during the previous school year. And we are the only school for the deaf in the United States that has a formal service learning program. And so this has been a tremendous opportunity for us to have this three-year grant to allow us to develop this program. The second area of grant comes to us through Perkins, and we have money to develop a visual communications program in our high school at the Oregon School for the Deaf. When it's completed, it will be an approved professional technical program, and our students will be able to leave the program with marketable skills in graphic design, computer-assisted drafting, video production, web design, computer programming, animation, and digital art. Technology is an area that we've had a lot of focus on because as a curricular area, there are virtually no barriers for students in this area, such as they might encounter in some other areas. School improvement planning is an area that both the Oregon School for the Blind and Oregon School for the Deaf consider to be very important. We have always put ourselves under all of the requirements of the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century. We are not technically subject to them because we are not technically school districts. However, since prior to this law being passed, we have always adhered to all of the school improvement requirements for school districts. In the interest of time, I'll go to slide 8, which looks at some system outcomes for the future. And the thing in particular that I would like to highlight for you here is in an effort to stretch our resources and to maintain our focus and our commitment to comprehensive programs for students, we are moving to consolidate some of the administrative function between the two schools for this next biennium and into the future. And to that end, we are eliminating two of our administrative or managerial FTE, and we'll have the areas of the plant operations and custodial, which is one area, the nutrition services and the student health services. Each of those areas will be under one supervisor for both of the schools. And in addition to that, the School for the Deaf this year eliminated an additional administrative position and combined the two program areas under one. And so it's our intention to continue to look for program efficiencies and make the best decisions we can to protect our programs and direct services for students. And the final thing that I'd like to say in terms of the future is that we really believe that our two schools are a valuable resource to the state. With our staffing and our facilities, we think that this is a role that we can play to support the Department of Education and the state in general, and hope to be able to continue to develop ourselves as a resource to others. In the last slide, I'd just like to close by saying we would welcome you to come and visit our schools, get to know our students and staff, and I recognize how busy you are, but at some point, at any point in the future, we would love to have you come and really get a firsthand knowledge of the programs and what we do there. We thank you for the support that you've provided to the schools, and we recognize that this is an investment that you're making in the students now, and we also see this as a very real investment in the future that will benefit all of the citizens in Oregon as our students mature and become productive citizens.
Representative Smith.
Thank you for the invitation. Last session, this committee, when I was on it, toured the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf, and it was one of the most moving experiences I've ever had since being in the legislature, actually life experience. And I was very impressed by the skill level and ability of your students at the School of the Deaf to be able to function just like other students, and to me that's so valuable. I think our students at the School of the Blind have many more challenges, however, because all the other things that go along with being blind, mental insufficiencies and so forth. And likewise, the students at the blind school were also able to perform, and I just was totally amazed by it. And I really thank you people for serving in that capacity.
Chair Morgan and Representative Smith, thank you very much.
Senator Mesley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thumbed ahead and was reviewing the document you have here from the parents, how they analyzed the program, and you rated very high, which is very impressive. But I had the question came to my mind, do you have a process where they can make suggestions, not only the parents but other stakeholders? And it'd be interesting if you could tell me some of the things that they're saying.
Chair Morgan and Senator Messerly, yes, we have several opportunities. We both have site councils which have parent members on those, and so that's one avenue, and they can be involved in all of the school improvement and policy discussions there. Periodic surveys such as this. The School for the Deaf also has a parent organization that meets monthly or every other month, depending on the need, and so that's an avenue. We welcome our families to come and drop into our classes. I told the staff when I first became the director and continue to tell them that, in my mind, parents should feel free to drop in at any time. We have, would love to have them come. One other opportunity that we provided this year is that in preparation for knowing that we would be facing some reductions in the budget this next biennium, we formed what we called a budget working group, and this consisted of parents as well as staff from both the School for the Blind and School for the Deaf, since we share a budget, and work through developing a set of recommendations as to how we would address reductions. And so we really do value parents as partners and like to provide opportunities for them to be involved with us. And this is a bit of a challenge because of the fact that so many of them live a distance away. And so I think maybe because it's a challenge, we spend perhaps more time thinking about how to involve parents.
Thank you, Paula, Madam Chair. Thank you. You know, granted that we are in a tough financial situation now, but are you getting suggestions, and could you tell us what some of those suggestions that they have mentioned to you or that you have yourself of how we could improve the programs and the offerings?
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, are you asking in terms of the recommendations for how to deal with the budget reductions?
No, simply on how the school operates and how they intermingle with the parents. And just any suggestions that the parents or the stakeholders might bring back to you or that you and your staff might be developing as to how we can improve in the future.
Yes, Chair Morgan and Senator Messerly, I think the thing that we hear from parents very often focus on how to make the programs we provide as real life and as near the workforce requirements and quality as we can make them. So, for example, are our high school programs designed to give our students the best opportunity possible to take an actual step into the workforce? Are they up to date? Do we understand what the current needs of the various technology areas are so that if we're offering a course that students can reasonably be expected to be able to go into the workforce and get that type of a job. Another area that's really important for all of our students is the area of developing self-confidence and the ability to develop good self-esteem, but the ability to become responsible social individuals. Very often students come to us having been somewhat isolated because of their need to depend on adults and adult interpreters or having been in situations where they only had a small number of people that they could communicate with individually, and there are oftentimes many social skills and ways of dealing with children and adults that they need to learn. And so that's a big focus that we provide, is just how do you become a responsible citizen and how do you handle communication, how do you handle frustrations. So I think probably the areas of the developing individuals' social-emotional skills as well as just the sound academic skills. And if a child is not someone for whom academic focus is the number one issue, then what we're looking at is skills that will allow that child to be independent, that will allow him to take what we would call academic skills but infuse those into real-life situations so that the math and the reading and the communication they develop, they can actually use in very real ways.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the presentation. I'll call next Rick Latour from the Office of Student Services. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Everyone is just finding the tab in their binders. Looking good. Please proceed.
Okay. Again, good morning. My name is Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Latour. I'm the Interim Associate Superintendent for the Office of Student Services. And it's a great pleasure to get to present to you on the work and the resources of our office this morning. The first slide, there we are. Is designed to demonstrate the funding sources for this office. As you can see, that the majority of the funds are both federal, with a smaller amount of general fund coming into the office, and as you can see, approximately 97% of the funds are grant and aid funds going directly to local school districts, with about 2.3% of the funding staying at the Department of Education for a combination of administration and program support. Slide 3 talks about the purpose of our office. while we administer a wide variety of offices, they do in fact share a common basis, and that's to ensure children that are intellectually capable. Unlike the special ed office, where children are being served who may have physical or mental challenges, our office is in fact designed to provide programs to those students who in fact are perfectly capable of reaching high academic standards, but may be in fact disadvantaged by environmental issues, primarily among them ethnic and cultural diversity, linguistic diversity, and most importantly right now in the Oregon economy, poverty. A key concept for these programs also that runs across all of them is that they are supplemental in nature. The intent of the programs primarily are intended to be additive, to add and expand upon the base program that the state provides for all of its students to ensure that we close an achievement gap or compensate, if you want, for those efforts or for those issues that do in fact impinge on the student's life. The analogy, the metaphor that gets used a lot by our federal funders is that the state is responsible for ensuring every child gets a ham sandwich. Some of the children are asked to get a slice of cheese on their sandwich, and that's a fairly good way to describe and think about our programs. There are actually four significant programs or program areas in the Office of Student Services. I'm going to be asking, with the chair's permission, to talk about the first two. And then again, as I've introduced myself as the interim, I'm going to ask the chair's permission to ask the directors of the last two programs to come and present on their programs. The first program are those that are under the No Child Left Behind legislation. You have heard significant discussions already in the hearings about No Child Left Behind and its broad implications for education today. There are 14 major programs within that legislation. The Office of Student Services currently administers and directs 11 of those programs, and I'll be talking about those more in a few minutes. These programs, of course, are primarily federally funded. The second program I will talk to you about is a competitive federal grant program. While relatively small program by many standards, this program comes through a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and, in fact, provides Oregon with an opportunity to combine or to build partnerships among those individuals, organizations, agencies, and businesses that have an interest in reducing the barriers, health barriers for children in terms of their ability to thrive and to learn in school. The third program, which I will ask when we get to that point, Dr. Joyce Doherty to describe to you, is our child nutrition programs. And then finally, Anita McClanahan, the Director of Early Childhood Education, will be here to address the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, which has represented a partnership with our federal Head Start program that effectively represents Oregon's commitment to its youngest citizens and learners over the last more than a decade. With that, I'll move on to discussing the first one, which is the No Child Left Behind program. This is the newly reauthorized legislation of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which, as Dr. Burke told you in his opening remarks, was first passed in 1965 and has been reauthorized approximately every 5 to 7 years since. The latest passage, called No Child Left Behind, was reauthorized in December of 2001. The funding here, again, support, it's all federal funding. We are placing approximately 97%+ of the funding in schools. The remaining portion stays with the Department of Education to administer those programs, and that's done by 21.05 FTE. The next slide is a listing of the 11 programs that we currently administer within the office. Of course, there isn't time to read or articulate all of these. I simply wanted to give you a listing of the programs, allow you to see what the titles were, and, of course, would be happy to answer any questions about any of the specific programs that you might want to ask.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I would just like to verify again how much the state has received in federal funds for No Child Left Behind.
Madam Chair, Senator Cordley, for all of the No Child Left Behind, what I would suggest is that I would get a complete accounting of that and bring it back to you, or I could look to Dave Fazier to provide that to you. The reason that I'm saying that is that, as you've heard from Bob Seward, their office administers three of the programs, and so the programs, the funding is actually across the agency. Also, there's No Child Left Behind funding within the Office of Assessment. So with that.
Question. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, for the record, Dave Fazier, Director of Management Services at the Department. We'll get that information for you. In particular, the federal funds dollars that you see in front of you are governor's balanced budget, and we have already spoken with LFO and the DAS analyst, and we'll be putting together, based on the latest information, legislatively adopted budget view that takes into account all the latest information from the president's budget.
I would be very interested in knowing for all of these different titles how much money comes with each title, and then how you break that out, whether all of that is a grant in aid or part of it is reserved for operations within the department.
Yes, Madam Chair. Would the in your federal funds tab in Binder 1, we have a representation that we would intend to give you updated with the latest information, and that does include everything that you've just stated.
Okay. Representative Smith.
Not for Dave Fager, but Mr. Latour.
Yes.
Title 4, 21st Century Community Learning Centers. What is that?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, that's a relatively new program to the Department of Education. It came with this reauthorization. The program has existed for a number of years. Title IV, this is Title IV-B, actually, the 21st Century Community Learning Centers program is a partnership or provides competitive funding, and it is a competitive grant, competitive funding to local agencies and schools, and they actually have to apply in partnership. This can include faith-based organizations. It can include community service organizations. It can include such organizations as the Boys and Girls Club. And what they will provide is activities generally after school, during summer, extended day, extended learning opportunities for children that are outside the regular school setting but that continue to build on the children's opportunity to learn and thrive in school. So it's an investment basically in ensuring that students have safe and productive areas to interact with other students and also have extended learning opportunities.
And you're going to give us the funding on that, yeah. Follow up. Title V, Promoting Parental Choice and Innovative Programs. Would you describe both of those for me?
I can't. Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, that's actually one program. It happens to have that title. It's primarily a function of two concepts, however. I'll speak to the second one first. The Congress for approximately 12 years, the last two authorizations, has been very interested in creating greater flexibility with federal funds for local school districts. Title V is, in fact, without doubt, the most flexible funding that the school receives. They receive this funding as formula, meaning that every school district gets part of that funding. And that funding can fund up to 26 different activities. I would go so far as to say it would be difficult to think of an educational activity that couldn't legitimately be funded under Title V. A key component of that, which is new in this authorization, however, is to ensure that in doing that, the parents are become an integral part of the discussion in terms of how those innovative programs are identified and funded, and hence the part on parent involvement.
Well, how does that work, parental involvement?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, parent involvement, to back up a little bit, The underlying concept is that when we look at the achievement, particularly of disadvantaged students, parent involvement has been shown within the research to be the greatest single predictor of student success. The opportunity for then for the school to actively seek ways to have the parents involved becomes critical. There's a couple of ways that it's done historically, and I'm going to suggest that there are some new ways that we're thinking about. Historically, parent involvement has been an opportunity to allow the parents to come into the school, be part of site committees, to be part of the ongoing decision-making, to receive communications from the school about the programs that are being offered, and to often take part in community-based involvement situations that we all hear about every spring, like the school carnival and school fair and the spaghetti feed. Increasingly, parent involvement is being, I think, revisited. Perhaps a major challenge to parent involvement in the past is it could be described as an opportunity for the school to tell the parents what they need to know. Increasingly, I think what schools are doing is reconfiguring themselves so that they parents have the opportunity to tell the school what they need to know and to be a part of the day-to-day decision-making. We also need to find ways to reward parents and to recognize parent involvement by those parents who never will set foot inside the school. An example, a parent who ensures that their child is well-fed, has an opportunity to have a place to study and complete homework, arrives at school with that homework, in fact, is a major contributor to the success of that school student, and, in fact, is greatly involved, and that needs to be recognized by schools as well.
Please proceed.
Thank you. I think what I'll do, if with the chair's permission, I'll go to number 8. This begins, Madam Chair, to give you some of the information that you were requesting. As was indicated, we have some updated numbers because these figures were prepared as recently as last Friday. We received some preliminary Title I figures, for example, which will change this. We will make those available to the committee. I did want to take a few minutes to talk about this. I also can provide for you FTE. Assigned to each of these programs, and we'd be glad to do that. What I'm illustrating in this slide is the current funding for this school year, as well as the projected funding for next school year, and then the president's budget for the 04, or the second year of the biennium. With the chair's permission and the committee's permission, I'd like to highlight a couple of these. Starting at the top with Title I-A, for disadvantaged students, we are gratified that we're looking at about a 12.9% increase in funding for next year. This is tempered to some degree by our knowledge now that we will be negotiating with the U.S. Department of Education our accountability system in Oregon, which will identify schools as making adequate progress or not making adequate progress. We anticipate in our current negotiations that we will be identifying hundreds of schools that will need additional support. Those schools, as they progress through their accountability system, will be required to set aside funding for providing additional services to children, including the choice to move to other schools, which if taken advantage of by the parents, is their right. The district will be providing transportation. My sense is that that will be require much of the increase to begin to be set aside for non-instructional activities. As I move down,
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley,
I want to make sure I understand what you're saying here, and I want to go back to, you know, late last week we heard that. The federal government is not going to allow Oregon to use the approach we heard about earlier to closing the achievement gap. And so what do we need to be aware of now with regard to how that disallowing will impact the budget? The budget choices within the Department of Education, because I just heard you make the statement about transportation. It sounds like a good deal of this money could be eaten up in transportation costs as opposed to instructional activity. Is that a part of what you're saying to us?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, as schools are identified as not making adequate yearly progress, it's a terrible phrase. Nobody strives to only be adequate, but that is what's in the law. If the district or the school does not make adequate progress for 2 years, the first sanction, if you want, is that they must offer every parent in the school the opportunity to move their child to a higher performing school. For those parents that wish to take advantage of that opportunity, the school district is responsible for providing the transportation. Because of the change that we anticipate, because as you rightfully suggested, the U.S. Department of Education has not accepted our first definition of adequate yearly progress, which would have identified, we believe, I'm going off projections only here, but what we would have assumed would have been 150 to 200 schools. We may be now looking at a majority of the schools in Oregon being identified. And because this applies to the sanctions that I spoke of, the transportation option applies to those schools receiving Title I funds. Therefore, our poorest schools receive Title I funds in the state. And that represents the, approximately 550 schools right now, the majority of those being elementary schools. They will, in fact, be required under the law to set aside up to 15% of their funds for transportation and of the funds they receive for Title I, and up to 5% additionally for supplemental services paid for by an outside provider.
And supplemental services would be inclusive of what?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the law specifies that the state is required to develop a list of supplemental service providers. We are in the process right now. We have on our website an application that can, the supplemental service provider can be a wide variety of agencies, organizations, entities, up to and including the school district itself, or an educational service district, but it also can be faith-based. It also can be private, a private corporation that provides educational services can also apply. Once they are on the state's list, it is the parents who are given the opportunity to select from that list those services that they want for their child, and the district is then obligated to provide those services and pay for them.
So we're talking about, Madam Chair, tutoring, something more? Something
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, primarily tutoring services, yes.
Like a Sylvan Learning Center.
For Madam today. Chair, Senator Gordley, correct.
Okay. Thank you.
If I could, I'll point out a couple of others. Title I-F, school improvement. Related to the conversation we've just been having, school improvement is a fund that was set aside by the U.S. Department of Education for those schools that were identified as very low performing. As you can see, that funding is scheduled to drop next year. We have had great success with that program, which I will talk about in my summary. And you can see that in the 04 fiscal year, it is scheduled to be zeroed out along with 45 other programs.
Question.
Representative Smith.
I noticed that is to be zeroed out. So was rural education. And then I noticed in family literacy, that shows a negative 31. What is the reasoning behind the federal government zeroing out some of these programs?
Chair Morgan, Representative Smith, I want to be clear, this is the President's proposed budget. This hasn't been acted on by the legislature at this point, but it is the only budget projection we have at that point. The President has expressed his interest in combining or eliminating funds and creating literally fewer educational programs coming from the federal government. In some cases, there's an expectation that funding will be moved into existing programs to bolster those programs. Most of them do not cover the ESEA programs that our office administers. As you can see, the majority of the programs are actually on the downside or have been eliminated in that budget period. That's all I know about the president's reasoning right now.
Okay. Madam Chair, could I follow up on Representative Smith's question? Would we see then, instead of the funding coming for rural education initiatives and for the low-performing schools, are we looking then to the Title 1A, 1D category to pull funds to serve those two categories?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, to the degree that Title I funding is available, it can in fact be used to support low-performing schools, and in fact will do that. The Rural School Initiative, however, is slightly different. That is actually a new program. It recognized, and I think rightfully, that many small and rural school districts, frankly, should not have to be put through the bureaucratic paperwork of coming after what were often tiny grants, sometimes less than $1,000, and to be held accountable to the outcomes of those grants. Therefore, what it provided was basically a block grant to very small school districts to use at their discretion, and most of those can be used for any of the activities, including Title I. Also, I would suggest Title II, which is a staff development program that Bob Seward described to you.
Yes. Thank you.
We are at the end of the time that we have allotted for the session today. And what I'll do is ask you when we come back to tomorrow to just continue through comments that you have relative to the funding. And we would be interested, too, in getting updated on what the Title I funds do look like. I'm personally curious whether they went up or down in the latest estimates that you had. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5014 and 5015 and adjourn the committee meeting, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.